This is Paul McGuire, and I want to take a moment to honor one of the finest programs that has ever aired on KBRT, the program Stand to Reason with Greg Kokel, who is celebrating his 17th year anniversary here on KBRT. One of the finest programs, Greg Kokel's program has made a tremendous impact for the kingdom of God. I have listened to it throughout the years myself for many, many years, and I want to salute Greg Kokel and thank him and thank the ministry of Stand to Reason and honor him for his 17-year anniversary here on KBRT.
Wow, that's a surprise. Not the 17-year anniversary. Of course, we saw that one coming, but for Paul to say those nice words. If you're listening from anywhere outside of Southern California, then you need to know that Paul McGuire sits in my chair during the week and does the Drive Time program here at our flagship station, KBRT. And it was so nice to hear from you, Paul. Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. And as you know, this is our – it just turns out that our anniversary date falls on a Sunday when we're actually broadcasting. So today marks – gee, it is very difficult. I mean, it's hard to imagine that we have been doing this for 17 years. So that makes me kind of an old-timer, I guess, in this business. 1990 is when Mr. Crawford and the Crawford Broadcasting Network gave me an opportunity to make a difference here through talk radio, and they gave me a mic on February 11th, 1990, and said, go. And when we started out, it was just one day a week, drive time. I think we started out on Sundays, three until six, and then very quickly, within a few months, we picked up an extra day. For a while, it was Sunday, Monday, and then it became Saturday, Sunday. And then for 8 years, I was with the Crawford Network working for them, doing the drive time on the weekend from 3 until 6. That's 6 hours of weekend drive time live radio, in addition to my regular job as an assistant associate pastor over at Hope Chapel at Hermosa Beach and some of the other things I was doing. And then we realized as Stand to Reason began to grow that, boy, this is a it's difficult in a sense having a part-time job and being beholden to a part-time employer in a weekend job with the radio and still be able to follow the direction that Stand to Reason was going, where I had speaking engagements and out-of-town things and everything. So I actually quit and resigned with Crawford Broadcasting and then bought back the time we had Stand to Reason, the same time slot that we had been broadcasting in. So I kept doing the same thing. Instead of getting paid for it, though, we began paying for it. And, of course, we shortened the program down to Sundays, 3 to 5. But I have been here pretty much solid since the beginning and glad to do so and glad to be reaching out to the rest of you, helping you out. 1-800-227-5278 is my number. And if you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150, pardon me, of course, that's the number you can call if you want to participate in conversation with me here on anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. And very early on in my career as a broadcaster, I decided that what I really wanted to do with the Christian world is to give you a piece of my mind and in the process show that Christianity was worth thinking about, that it could compete in the marketplace of ideas if it was properly understood and properly articulated. And so that has been our goal, as my goal as a broadcaster for 17 years. And certainly then when we started Stand to Reason a few years, 4 years or so after I started broadcasting, this was a corporate goal of the broadcast presence and the organization. And for all these years, we have been very happy to be here for you, so you could call us. And now at the World Wide Web, for all intents and purposes, our broadcast footprint is the world. And we're really glad to be able to offer, as I often put it, nothing buttery, real, believable Christianity. And just putting it right out there, so no frills. Just a straightforward approach, and I think we've been doing a good job at that. We're glad to be able to be here and thankful that God has given us the opportunity and thankful that you're listening. And many of you have not just listened, but you sent financial help to help us to pay for this program, and we're glad. And we'll continue to be here as long as you will in that regard, and God wills, who really has the last say about everything. Now, as I start out today, as waiting for your calls, Gee, I see the first question here, is God necessary? I'm going to come to that in just a minute from our friend in Bahaba, Maine. But it's interesting because it really fits in with some things I wanted to open up with. I ran into a dear friend a couple of nights ago who ended up spending the evening at her home, and she did some work with my wife at an event that my wife was sponsoring for single moms. And we got to talking, and she's been a part of Stand to Reason for quite a number of years now, and I think deeply influenced by what we do here at STR. And I'm glad to see that because her life has had a lot of twists and turns, and we're glad to be able to have an impact in a good way for the things that she's had to face. But, of course, when we get together, we talk a lot about thinking and thoughtful and careful Christianity. And she was telling me about an attorney that she has that was really quite a friend of hers that was quite disdainful of Christianity and the whole Christian trip. And it was reminiscent to me of a whole raft of people who are so dismissive of theism in general and Christianity in specific, and nowadays not just dismissive in a passive kind of way, oh, go away kind of attitude, but are dismissive in an aggressive way with the Richard Dawkins and the Sam Harrises and the Daniel Dennetts, the new wave of atheists that are taking a shot at Christianity and doing so quite aggressively and publishing a lot of works. And, of course, this is one of the things that we realize we're going to have to speak to. As we represent Christ as ambassadors from Stand to Reason, and those of you who are ambassadors for Christ, representing Him in the United States at least, because this is one of the big obstacles facing us. We have, I think, this issue, the new atheist, the so-called new atheist. No really new arguments, just a lot of new attitude, and the situation with Islam and the concern about postmodernism and the emerging church. These are all areas that we need to address as a church, and Stand to Reason is taking some particular look at, and we want to be a place that you can come to for answers about these things. But just a reflection on the so-called new atheists, and this is what we were talking about the other night, is some people have this idea that that theism in general, and Christianity in particular, is just a house of cards. I mean, to think of to listen to what they say and to read some of what they have written, they are so utterly dismissive. Like Bill Maher says, if you believe in religion, it's a mass psychosis. You're out of your mind. You're crazy. And Richard Dawkins has said essentially the same thing. And people shouldn't be allowed to believe crazy things. And Sam Harris has the same disdain. And when you look at their arguments, though, their arguments are quite shallow. And oftentimes they attack more what people who claim to be Christians do. They overblow the significance of that, and then they dismiss that which they say they represent, never asking the question of whether these people who do these evil things or unpleasant things are actually representing the thing that they're rejecting, biblical Christianity, the teachings of Jesus, the worldview of a Judeo-Christian perspective. And what I told my friend is that, you know, Christianity can't be dismissed that easily. It just isn't going to go away. And the reason is it's not this house of cards. It's not this little thing. You find one little questionable thing in the Bible, and you have the freedom to completely disregard all of this. It's not going away, and it doesn't have durability because there are a bunch of idiots who believe it, and they don't go away. There are a lot of idiots who believe stupid things that aren't going away, and those things are still stupid, but they keep them going. That's not the issue with Christianity. The reason that Christianity isn't going away is because it's not a house of cards. It's a big, giant, complex, durable thing. It is a way of thinking. It's an ideology. It's an explanation of reality that has been I'm trying to think of an appropriate metaphor that has been bolted to reality. It's a point of view that has been bolted to reality. I was in a house that was being rebuilt across the street that had burned down a year or so ago. Some of you remember. I told you, waking up in the middle of the night, 3 a.m, pound, pound, pound on the door. My house is on fire, and then going over and, you know, doing what we could until the fire trucks arrived. Well, that's being rebuilt, but you can see on the inside now there are big metal things attached to the studs. It's not just studs with 16s toenailed in to hold the thing up. Those are nails, by the way. But big metal things with bolts and, you know, all this other hidden stuff, it's there to secure this for, to make it safe from earthquake. This whole house is bolted down to the ground in lots of different ways. And the same thing is true of Christianity. It's not this just flimsy structure that somebody sunk a couple of 16s in, and the first guy to come up by it that can huff and puff real strong is going to blow this thing away. This is a system that, as it turns out, is bolted down to reality. Now, I'm using these terms advisedly because, you know, for a thing to be true in the classical sense is you have to have a point of view that fits the way the world really is. And so when the world is the way you think it is, then that's the classical understanding of the word truth. It's true that I'm on this radio show right now because here I sit. And so my statement fits the way the world really is. And when it comes to all the particulars of Christianity, there are so many ways that the Christian worldview, properly understood, is bolted down to reality. It is going to be very hard to shake this one free. Now, I understand there are some problems with it, and there are questions that people raise, but we just didn't make this up overnight. We are not just simply emoting. And when I say we, I mean those who, I probably should say, oh, how could I put this? There are a lot of Christians that are just emoting. But those who understand the thing itself as we've received it over 2,000 years and understand its deep structure, we know that this can be defended apart from one's feelings, apart from one's fantasies or wishful thinking. Frankly, there's a lot of things about Christianity I wouldn't wish up, nor would you. It's counterintuitive, but I don't think I really mean that. I think it's deeply intuitive, but I think it's counter to what natural man would come up with. If we were just going on our own devices, we wouldn't want a God that's just watching everything, making a list and checking it twice. But our intuitions are such that we believe in justice and that no crime should go unpunished, and that's in place, and that's the way Christianity operates. Now, there is a means of mercy in the midst of this far-reaching and thoroughgoing justice, and that's part of the message, of course. But my conviction is that the foundational principles of Christianity resonate with our deepest intuitions, and this is why I can go into a philosophy class, and I can say, let me give you five or six foundational elements of a Christian worldview, and I think you're going to have a hard time arguing against these notions taken individually. Yet these are the things that make up the foundation stone and the basic superstructure of the view we call Christianity. Now, you might want to fuss about the window dressing. Okay, fine. But you're not going to, I think, going to be able to find too many things wrong with that which is at the foundation. I'll tell you quite simply, for example, one of the foundational cosmological questions is why something is rather than nothing is. Why is anything here at all? And by the way, we happen to know through science that it wasn't always here. You know, we've got the second law of thermodynamics saying that things are rolling down, running down. They must have been run up at some time. They've been running down forever. They'd be dead right now. The universe would have stopped long ago. Now, the universe is not infinite. And this is from the deliverances of secular science, not my religious wishful thinking. That means the whole physical thing came into existence at some point before which there was none of that. Now, what caused this kind of thing? To suggest that someone outside of the physical system caused it, someone, by the way, not something, is completely reasonable. In fact, it seems to be the inescapable conclusion of modern physics. Now, could I be wrong? Yeah, maybe. But it's not nothing is the point that I'm making. You can't just make God go away because you don't like him looking over your shoulder. It turns out that this is our explanation explains what it means to explain. It is adequate to do the job. And not only does it explain why we got here or that we got here, that everything got here. Evolution doesn't answer that question, by the way. doesn't explain everything getting here to begin with. It only explains how it developed, or it purports to explain. Not only does it do that, but, it, you know, Richard Dawkins was the one that says the biological world is a complex world that gives every appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Now, he's quick to add that don't be misled by appearances. We know better. Well, I'm not so sure that they know better, that the apparent watchmaker design was really the blind watchmaker of natural selection and genetic mutations, that is Darwinian, neo-Darwinian evolution. That's what he holds. But do you notice what he says? He says, gee, it sure looks designed. Now, I think there are real problems with Darwinism. But even if I were willing to grant that that's a possible way of explaining design, maybe another possible legitimate, reasonable, rational way of explaining design is through design. How about that? Maybe the world looks designed because it is designed. I mean, is that outlandish? No, that's not outlandish at all. There's nothing odd about that, is the point that I'm making. And so the Christian worldview has one big bolt to reality. We can explain the non-physical source of all physical things. And we can explain it in terms of something we already understand. It's called agency, agent causation. We know that agents can start things from nothing. How do I know that? Because we do it all the time. We initiate action. We are not just dominoes. A domino in the string of dominoes doing what the domino before us forced us to do, we have freedom. This is obvious to most people. This is why we condemn criminals and punish them, and we award people who do fine things because they deserve it in both cases, because they're morally free creatures. And to be free means that you can start actions. And so we're familiar with this ability of starting things. Agents start things. Things don't start things. Things just react to things before them. But agents can start things. And if the whole physical universe was started, it seems reasonable that some non-physical agent did so, who himself was not started by something else. Now, maybe we can talk more about it. You're not persuaded. I'm not trying to persuade you that it happened. I'm trying to show you that it's reasonable. It's eminently reasonable. And those are just two points. Cosmology and design, teleology, that are solid anchors to reality for the Christian worldview, and there are a bunch more of those kinds of things. Got to go to break. We'll get to your calls coming up in just a moment when I do, but let me leave you with this thought on my 17th anniversary of broadcasting, and that is theism and Christianity in particular is not a house of cards. It's a big, giant, substantial thing bolted down. Now, it might be that some kind of hurricane or tsunami can uproot it, but it's not going to go easily, which means Sam Harris et al. have their work cut out for them if they're going to take this one down. And it's going to take a whole lot more than a little bit of hand-waving to do it. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind here, and I will be back in just a moment with your calls.
1-800- Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. Do you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians, just like you, to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material too by using the brand new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challenges in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org or call 1-800-2-REASON.
Greg, please pardon the interruption, but the entire staff is here.
Come on in here, everyone.
Let's see if we can all fit inside here. Greg, the entire KBRT staff wants to thank and congratulate you, the Enforcer, and the entire Stand to Reason organization on this, your 17th anniversary. So here goes.
Happy anniversary, Stand to Reason. Happy anniversary.
Oh, happy anniversary. Well, that's great. That's another surprise for me. Thank you so much, KBRT staff. Let's see, we got a lot of calls on the line, so let's just jump right in and celebrate our anniversary here, our 17th year, with doing what we do, what we've been doing for 17 years, taking your calls. Let's go to Tim first in Bahaba, Maine. Tim, hi. Wait, we got to get your button there. I pushed him on this end. Still working on it. What happened? Tim. Oh, gosh. All right, I'm going to put him on hold. Do you have his button pushed and his pot up? Huh. I'm sure he's still there. Okay, I'm going to just put you on hold, Tim, so maybe they can find you. Let's try Dan. Dan, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great.
Hi, Greg.
Why don't you go ahead, Dan?
Hey, Greg. Actually, before I have my question, I wanted to tell you this for a long time. I've 7 years ago, before I started courting my wife, I gave her your tapes of decision making and the will of God.
Ah, no kidding.
No, just to kind of see where she was at.
Uh-huh.
If I was interested in her, I wanted to dig in and find out where she was at spiritually. And, you know, if she came back and told me that it was a bunch of hogwash, I think I would have said, okay, bye.
Okay, yeah, well, you know what? On that issue, it's like, obviously I have my point of view reflecting in that those tapes, but whatever your point of view is, you better make sure that you and your wife are of the same mind on this one, you know, because it's just going to create a lot of hardship if you're not moving in the same direction as to how you understand God directs in your life. And I'm glad that apparently, well, you said your wife, when you're courting her, so apparently she responded well.
Yes, well, I've learned a lot from your teaching, and when she came back and said that she found it very sound teaching, I decided to pursue her, and yeah, we've been married for 6 years now.
Good for you! Congratulations, Dan.
So, all right, my question revolves around a rock climbing club that I've started.
Oh, no kidding!
And I know that I heard you a little while back talking about climbing over Joshua Tree.
Yeah, I used to work for Summit Ministry, kind of during the summer. And Tim Hansel's old group, and I used to climb pretty regularly on my own with other groups also from Azusa Pacific College, then a college, now a university, but over at Joshua Tree. So I've climbed the Cyclops probably 50 times, you know, the Eye of the Cyclops over there by the campground?
I remember you saying that. In fact, that's on my webpage on the group homepage.
It's a great first climb because there's nice feel. It's not that difficult, but you got a nice feeling of exposure and you get some height, so it's easy to anchor, so it's good. So
definitely
good for you, Dan.
And so you know, I didn't find what I was looking for anywhere else online, so I decided to start a club. And It's called Solid Rock Climbing Club.
And, good.
You know, it's not a Christian club.
It's not always solid rock over at Joshua Tree, by the way. It's quartz monzonite chips off of
right,
it. But,
right.
Yeah, okay.
But I'm talking about Jesus, really.
Sure, I understand.
But it's not a Christian club. I specifically didn't want it to be a Christian club.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't turn off people who might, you know, not want to go for Climbers for Christ or something like that, right? Christians would know what solid rock means. Non-Christians wouldn't, and it would give me opportunity to have relationships and store where I could.
Mm-hmm.
So as I'm getting into it, it's about a month old now, and I'm kind of thinking through some things and issues that are coming up and will come up, and some of them it basically has to do with standards that I may or may not have for the club.
Okay.
And I wanted to get your advice.
Sure.
Because, you know, on the one hand, I'm figuring, okay, I'll be bringing my kids on trips and camping trips. And, you know, in general, the climbing culture is pretty free. And so I'm thinking, I'm anticipating there's going to be people shacking up in tents, right? Or drinking or whatever. And, you know, I was thinking on the one hand, as a club, I could have standards that would say, hey, you know, let's have a family atmosphere here. But on the other hand, those same standards may cause people to not come. Those people who I do want to minister to.
Right, sure.
And so I just wanted to...
So what do you do in a situation like that? Let me toss out a couple of thoughts that maybe provide some guidelines for you, and then we'll work a little closer to a solution. I think ultimately you're going to have to weigh a couple of different things. One of them is the principle, and I think it's 1 Corinthians 5, where Paul says we're not to judge outsiders. It's the ones inside the church that we're to judge. So there is a sense in which, as a general rule, broadly put, that we are not to demand that non-believers live like believers.
Right.
And we shouldn't be surprised when they don't.
Right.
And we shouldn't make that the issue itself, like, how dare you do that sin? Oh, that's naughty. You, what kind of person are you? Well, they're the same kind of people as we are, you know, by and large. And maybe the Lord's worked on us a little bit and made us a little bit better, but probably not much better, you know, compared to Jesus. So Paul just warns us to be careful of that. Now, however, if it's in your own home, all right, well, you have some non-Christians over, you do have standards for your house that I think it's appropriate. So if I had non-believers come over to my house and they're staying overnight, I wouldn't probably let, you know, people sleep together who weren't married. But that would be their act of honoring me in my own home, because this is my home after all. So now you have to decide whether your club is more like your home than it is like a broad enterprise in the world, as it were. If it's meant to be, in a sense, not a Christian enterprise, but a means of getting people of like mind and like interests together, so that in that atmosphere, you as a prime mover in that enterprise can begin to have an impact for them for Christ, then I think you have to be very spare in terms of the moral requirements. I'll talk about what that might look like. If you're seeing this as, in a sense, more your home, like this is a ministry and it's going to maybe be seen more like that, or this is a family enterprise and your kids are going to be along all the time, and what that looks like is you don't want them in the contact that you have with other people through this work to be exposed to certain kinds of things that you think immoral, then your rules are going to be different. But if you make your rules different, I think, especially like, you know, no shacking up in the tents type thing, then I think it's going to really cut back on the number of people that you're going to have there of the kind of people you want to reach.
That's right.
Now, if you have Christians, let's say you don't have this rule, say about shacking up, but you have Christians that are with you, I think it's fair on the, you know, on the private to talk to these people and say, you know what, you're a follower of Christ, you shouldn't be shacking up anywhere.
Right.
And so in virtue of the fact that you're a, you know, that you are claimed to be, you know, part of the family. You know, this is, you know, this is what I'm going to require of you in this circumstance. Not because we require it of everybody, but, you know, it says don't judge those outside the church, but judge those inside the church. That's Paul's specific directive there. So you may want to approach them a little differently than the others if you happen to know they're followers of Christ and have been around long enough to know better.
Yeah.
As far as the exposure of your children to people sleeping in the tent together.
And I'm also thinking, gosh, in today's world, there's a whole lot more, right? I mean, even open homosexual,
Yeah, and so that would kind of fall in that category, and that's when you – and I think I guess if I were in your shoes on that one is I would – rather than trying to insulate my kids from ever seeing that, I'd rather want to educate them regarding the behavior in their midst insofar as they are now engaging people in the world. And you can give them the same directive that we're talking about from Paul, well, these are things that are wrong, but these people don't know any better, or they don't believe that, or they are not followers of Jesus, and so they're going to live in ways that are not happy, the Lord's not happy with. But here's how we're going to act towards them, and then you can flesh that out a little bit for them. Now, there's some places that I would draw the line, but I draw the line in areas that are more that I think the non-believer is going to have a more general acknowledgement that this is something that is a legitimate kind of restriction given the group. For example, you might say, and put it in politically correct ways or not, you say foul language, swearing and stuff like that, okay? You could say, here's the deal. We have this group, but there's going to be some rules for our group, and they're rules that reflect us being really wanting to be sensitive to other people. And so since we have women and we have children, we're going to watch our mouth. And so don't be surprised if you start getting a little wild here if I say something to you about it because of this. Okay? And maybe there's some dress things, I don't know. You have to decide on that. But people are walking around in the all together in the morning. That's not good for everybody. And so, but I think those are the kind of restrictions that you could say that would, it won't be a free for all, for one. It isn't going to be like any old rock climbing camp, but it's not going to be burdensome. It's probably those kinds of things that you might impose are the kinds of things that pretty much everybody agree are probably a good idea for around here, There are married guys, so if the girls are running around that, in a compromised way, this isn't good for the married guys who've got commitments to their own wives. So these things up front you might express, but I wouldn't have too many things in that list or I'll start seeing them oppressive. So,
and I don't have any, I don't want this to be a church.
Sure, right? Of course. So I that's what I would say. Something along that line, and you can decide. Basically, you have some guidelines that seem to be the kind of thing that most civilized people would acknowledge as being a good neighbor to the people around them, and especially when you have women present, you have married people present, and you have children present. And so everybody plays by those rules and everybody agrees to it. Now, if they don't agree to it, then they can climb somewhere else. But I suspect if there are these broader kind of things that I just described, that you're not going to lose too many of the people that you really want to reach. But I wouldn't I wouldn't be vetting their bedding arrangements, kind of thing, unless what was going on was disruptive to the group. Mm-hmm. Without being too specific here on the air.
Right.
And then I would just take your own children aside and just use this as an opportunity to educate them as to what Paul was talking about in, I think it's 1 Corinthians 5. Mm-hmm. How's that sound?
Yeah, I've been leaning towards that way, and it's just been mm-hmm. something I thought I needed to get some more advice on.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that's right.
Make sure you're of one mind with your wife on these issues, too, because, wives have a little different perspective, and they could add something that maybe you didn't see, especially they're a little more protective of family and children and those kinds of things. So see what she has to say mm-hmm. as well. It is 1 Corinthians 5. I just looked it up.
Okay, great.
So there's something for you. Good talking to you, Dan.
Thank you, Greg.
All the best.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to try Bar Harbor now. Tim?
Hi.
We got you.
Greg?
I'm glad we found you.
Yeah, well, I don't know what happened. As soon as you sounded like you were about ready to come to me, the whole phone went dead. So.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, we got you now.
Good.
So what's on your mind?
Well, I've got a question about how sure I should be when I debate with, like, say, an atheist. I do a lot of debating online, and, whenever I can meet with someone, like a friend of mine is atheist, we're always talking about this thing.
Uh-huh.
And what seems to frustrate them the most when they say, well, couldn't it be that God really doesn't exist? And I tell them, no, it could not be. It has to be that God exists. And they get so angry. You mean you're telling me that you can't be wrong? And then whenever they put you or I, you know, into it. Of course, mm-hmm. I'd be wrong. But, you know, should I just go with the, you know, should I just accept, say, okay, let's say it's possible that he doesn't, or should I stay hardlined?
Okay, it depends on what you mean. When you say that God is necessary, you might mean that it is your conviction that all of the evidence points to God so forcefully that you have the maximum psychological certainty that what you're saying is true. Now, I've really stretched that out, and it sounds so cumbersome, but we want to be careful with exactly what we mean by these things. We might really be talking about our level of conviction. And so we say, God, no, I think I'm not wrong. I can't be wrong. My evidence is too great. There's no possible way I could be mistaken. And what you're talking about is your level of conviction based on the justification that you have for your views. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just simply saying that's one thing. Another thing could be, because of the nature of the thing, it is impossible that God not exist. It's just like it is impossible that square circles do exist. It's impossible that God not exist. That's called metaphysical necessity, by the way. And that is in no possible consideration of any world could it be the case that God doesn't exist. And then when you have a thing that's metaphysically necessary, of course you're going to have kind of psychological confidence in that too. I mean, I have maximal psychological confidence, certainty that square circles don't exist because of the nature of metaphysical necessity. I do not have that kind of confidence about the existence of God and the truthfulness of Christianity. Not the same confidence as there not being any square circles. And the reason is I don't know that it's that the existence of God is metaphysically necessary. Certainly Christianity isn't. If God does exist, he could have, you know, it might have been that he chose not to redeem the world so he wouldn't become a man and in Jesus, and you know, all those other particulars wouldn't apply. So my suspicion is what you're talking about is your level of confidence based on the information you have, that you don't think you could possibly be mistaken, and that's that's one thing you have to answer. I mean, if that's what you mean, you have to decide that. Now, I don't think that anybody who really, really doesn't believe it's even possible for them to be mistaken should say, "Well, maybe I'm mistaken," just to move the conversation along. I don't say it's not possible for me to be mistaken, because I think, in fact, truly and authentically, it is possible for me to be mistaken about Christianity and theism. Now, I think the case for theism is stronger than Christianity, but not that the case for Christianity is weak, but I mean, I have a lot more confidence that some form of theism is true, and then it's all the particulars of Christianity that follow that have their own level of justification. But I am very comfortable talking to people and saying, yeah, maybe, I guess I could be mistaken on this. In fact, I mentioned that earlier in my opening comments. But I am confident that I'm not mistaken, and the reason I'm confident is that I have good reasons. I'm not, as I put this frequently to audiences, I'm not making it up, and I'm not just emoting. I have an argument. Now, I could be wrong on that, but you're going to have to disabuse me of my reasons before you can refute my argument. And that's where the attention has to be directed. So you have to take stock of your own level of confidence. If you have this overarching, I mean, if you have this profound sense of certainty that you can't see how it's possible that you could be mistaken, well, then I don't think you should say otherwise. Now, you might not go ahead and mention that particular point, though, because you see what happens when you do.
Yeah.
What happens? He gets mad.
Yep.
And now with all the other obstacles that you have to overcome, you've got a new one.
Well, I found that question always arises when I'm debating with the atheist.
What is the question again?
Well, that question that couldn't you be wrong, that God doesn't exist. And that's what I was saying. That's why I was wondering from you. Sure, I know what you're saying about – well, actually, I was going by sheer logic. Out of nothing – nothing comes. I mean,
yes, you know, and I think, why don't you hold on for a minute, Tim? I'll come back to you, and then we'll finish up this segment before another caller. I'm pushing a break right now. So
good. Hold
on. I'll be back and answer that question about out of nothing, nothing comes when we return here on Stand to Reason.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on, is the supernatural real? Is Jesus a prophet or the Son of God? Do all roads lead to God? Did Jesus rise from the dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at sdr.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Greg Kokel back with you here at Stand to Reason on our 17th anniversary for broadcasting. Actually, you know, Stand to Reason didn't come in until later, about 4 years after I started, so... Strictly speaking, it's only been 14 years with Stand to Reason, but it's been 17 years with me behind this particular microphone, and glad to be able to do it. Let's go back to Tim in Bar Harbor, Maine, and talking about whether God is necessary or not and the best way to work with people on this. The way I would argue, Tim, when you're talking to an atheist, as you're giving the argument, I would argue that the smart money is on the odds-on favorite. And it seems to me the odds-on favorite here is some form of theism, because it's for reasonable people it is indisputable that the universe is not eternal. That means it came into existence at some point. Now, you say, well, from nothing, nothing comes, and that is a dictum that I think is very reliable. However, I read a book by Greg Gansel, Christian philosopher over at the Rivendell Institute, and it's an excellent book. It's actually the best introduction to a philosophy of religion I've ever read, because it's so accessible. I mean, a high schooler, junior higher can read this and follow it, but it's profound, and I love his style. It's called Thinking About God. It's very good. But in this book, he argues that to him it is not a necessary dictum that something that nothing comes from nothing. He thinks it's highly unlikely, but he's not comfortable with saying that it's impossible. And so he doesn't argue that way. Now, so if here's a, you know, a Christian philosopher is not willing to stake everything on that dictum, then, you know, I don't know that we have to do that. But he doesn't think that that hurts our case at all, because even if it's, you know, you might think in the realm of possibility that something could come from nothing. Is it reasonable, is it most reasonable to believe that everything came from nothing? And the answer to that is probably no. And so my case is that I am trying to demonstrate that not only is Christianity reasonable, that is somebody's within reason to hold the particulars of the Christian worldview, but it is also eminently reasonable. It is on balance, I think, where the smart money should be placed, because it's an odds-on favorite. And that, I think, is the best way to argue. I find it actually disarming for atheists when I can say in good conscience, you know, maybe it's possible I'm wrong. I mean, that occurs to me enough times to be at least be able to acknowledge it to you. But, you know, just because it's possible to be mistaken doesn't mean that I am mistaken. And I mean, it's possible the atheist is mistaken too. I mean, let's be fair. Isn't it possible you're mistaken? Okay, so let's just say it's possible, even if you said this. Let's just say for the sake of argument, it's possible we're both mistaken. Do you think it's a flip of the coin? No, we can look at the evidence and see what's most reasonable. And when you go to cosmology and teleology and morality and all these other things and the person of Jesus and the Bible and a bunch of other things that you might bring into the mix, our deep intuitions about the way the world actually is, it starts looking more and more reasonable. And that's what I'm looking for with an atheist. I want him to see that this is more reasonable, not that there's no chance I could be mistaken. I want him to see that maybe there's a chance I could be mistaken, but man, think about what the atheist is committed to. Everything comes from nothing. Is that a mouthful? How about this? Life comes from non-life. How about consciousness comes from matter?
Well, that's what I said. Inanimate objects will eventually, given enough time, develop into thinking.
Why would somebody say that? He says that or you?
Well, no, that's why I said, you know, look at what you're saying. That's what I say to him. Look what you're saying.
Right.
Given enough time, and this made them mad. I called it the triune God of chance, time, and matter.
Right. Well, yeah, but it is like that. And I don't know why it has to make him mad. Maybe you're being a little strident in the way you're communicating. But look at, I mean, he is faced with having to say that everything came from nothing, that life comes from non-life, that order comes from chaos, that consciousness comes from matter, that natural law comes from, you know, chance. I mean, don't these things seem on their face patently absurd? But there is nothing absurd on the face of it, of believing in God. I mean, that's not absurd. If it were absurd, most of the people wouldn't naturally lean that way. Now, some people want to just dismiss it. Well, that's a psychological projection, whatever. Well, maybe, maybe not. I'm just simply arguing it's not absurd. It isn't like, you know, believing in, you know, square circles or something like that.
Yeah.
There are good reasons to infer the existence of a supranatural or supernatural consciousness that is responsible for everything else. Now, the inference may not be entirely correct. I'm willing to talk about that, but it's not nothing. It's not silly. And so when you consider what an atheist has to commit himself to, that, I think, is a stretch.
Yeah.
That's the difficult thing.
Right.
And that's what I'm going to be trying to show him. What's more reasonable?
Yeah. Well, this gentleman that wrote the book, what do you call it? God, Talking About God?
It's called Thinking About God. Oh. Greg Gansel. Oh, yeah, that would be one you could buy, give to your friend, read yourself, talk to him about. It's very good.
Well, does he give some kind of a model on how something could be into being?
No, he doesn't. He just says conceptually it's not clear to him that something could come from nothing. By the way, there's no model that you can construct here. Because how could something come from nothing? What you have to do is you have to make assessment of your intuitions. What does it seem like to you given your understanding and grasp of reality? Now, I wouldn't be surprised if Greg Gansel hasn't run into enough atheists for whom it was not patently obvious that nothing comes from nothing. And so he's going to say, well, gosh, I guess this isn't based on our intuitions about the thing a given, because a lot of people don't seem to grasp this. So I'm not even going to go there. I'm just going to say, all right, well, maybe you're right. Maybe something could come from nothing. But do we have any reason to believe this thing came from nothing?
Yeah.
What's the best explanation? And go from there. That would be my tactic.
That sounds like good.
Okay, Tim.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad we finally got to you there at Bar Harbor, or I should say Bahaba. Let's go to Alton, New Hampshire, and Ed. Welcome to Stand to Reason, Ed. Greg Kokel, hi.
Hey, thanks so much, and congratulations on your anniversary.
Thank you. I can't believe it's been so much for your ministry. You're welcome.
My wife and I give financially whenever we can, and I certainly would like to encourage anyone listening, since indeed my question is about entertainment, is maybe take a look at what we're spending and throw some of that your way. Because
okay, well, I
certainly a lot more worthwhile than some of the junk I've spent money on.
I'll give you an amen to that one.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ed.
You're very welcome. And Anyway, my question is really about movies. I like movies. Some I won't go see, but there's certain things, especially mm-hmm. some of the animation, mm-hmm. That I enjoy. And I'm also a writer of fiction. And my question is, are we in some way celebrating or at least enjoying sin when we enjoy a movie? Because without sin, it seems to me there wouldn't be any plot lines.
Well, if you put it that way, if that's your criterion, then anything with a plot line would fail that criterion. Because, I mean, what? Not, I don't think that all plot lines require sin, but they do require conflict. So not all conflict would be sin, but usually conflict entails somebody sinning. Now, it doesn't mean that just because you're following a story and you're enjoying the unfolding of the story, that what you're doing is celebrating the sins that move the storyline along. If that were the case, then the Bible would fall prey to that as well. The Bible's thick with sin, and it's nasty stuff.
Right.
And frankly, much of the stuff in the translation occasionally you see, it's sometimes sanitized, but in the original it's pretty rugged. And even with the sanitized versions, you know, when Paul says, I wish they would mutilate themselves in Galatians, I think, and what he means is I wish they would castrate themselves, I don't have to go into all the details of different ones like that, but they're like that. But even with that sanitization, it's still pretty rough going when you read the stories, particularly in the Old Testament, of the very nasty people that God used and rescued. So if that's your criterion, I think even the Bible is going to be squeezed out. I think that that the standard that one that's important to me, and this is quite subjective at this point, so I just want to warn people, it isn't the same standard everybody needs to have. I think people have to kind of come to some conclusions based on their own sensibilities,
right?
Which is hard because, you know, we're sinners and, you know, we're not perfect in the way we do this, and sometimes we have motivations that are down deeper than we're aware of. And so we think we have some noble purpose and we're really just – it's some seedy enterprise that we're interested in and we're not as noble as we think we are. But be that as it may, having said that, with that qualification, my wife and I like watching movies. We enjoy this. We don't get to do it very often because there just isn't much time. And we don't go to the theater very often, although we should more often just to have a date. Although the Wilberforce movie is coming out, Amazing Grace, and that might be a good one to see on the big screen. And we like to see the big dramatic presentations on the big screen because it's more dramatic. But we usually end up watching DVDs kind of thing. But even that takes a lot of time. So what we are sensitive to is when evil is glorified by the movie taken as a whole, not if there are occasions of evil in the film.
Right.
In fact, if you don't have those – you have no story. And if you think of, I was just thinking of Jesus, the Passion of the Christ. Well, there's a lot of nasties there.
Right.
All the whipping and the crucifixion and all that. I mean, that's bad.
Right. Well, that's the point. If it weren't for the existence of evil or sin, that's why I'm saying that,
yeah,
it probably wouldn't be a reason for the movie to begin with.
Yeah. But you see what happens with that way of thinking is that you'd end up disqualifying everything. And I think that's too much. I don't think there's anything wrong with the fact that a movie is, or any kind of fiction or any story is moved forward by the conflict that's a result of somebody's sinful actions. That's life. It's what one does with the story. And I think that there is sometimes redemptive elements. My wife and I walked out.
And I agree. I mean, and to me, certainly the movies I enjoy the most are the ones with the obvious redemptive elements.
Either redemptive elements, or they are really there's something beautiful about the expression of virtue.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you a movie that's got a combination of both of those, and we just watched it again, and we never tire of it, is Anne of Green Gables. My daughter loves it. She's only two, but she knows Anne of Green Gables, man. She loves it. And my wife, we cannot watch for 10 minutes without getting choked up, because there's redemption in this series, and there's beautiful characterization. It's funny, and it's very, very tender. And so all of these things touch us. But sometimes we're touched by things that aren't quite so tender, but they're still significant. I was going to make a comment about two other movies that we walked out of because we didn't like what was happening. And we thought initially that it was a glamorization of violence and evil and a celebration of it. It turned out we were wrong, but we didn't see the ending. One of them was Fargo, and the other one was Training Day. And both of those things, the bad guy in the end got his comeuppance. And there was a redemptive theme, as it were, but we just didn't wait around for that. So you might want to err on the side of being conservative in some of these things, but ultimately it's going to be an individual choice. I hope that helps, Ed. And you've got some guidelines for how to choose between movies. 1-800-227-5278. We're coming into hour number two. That means more time for conversation with you right here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
I want to salute one of the finest programs that has ever aired on KBRT, Stand to Reason with Greg Kokel. I salute Greg Kokel and the important role he has played with the ministry of Stand to Reason. I want to thank him and thank the ministry of Stand to Reason for 17 fine years here on KBRT.
I go along and agree with you about Greg Kokel. I also congratulate him.
Well, I just can't take it, man. There's just so much coming down today. Thank you so much for those kind words, and I do appreciate it coming from colleagues as well here at KBRT. I started out talking in this show when I kind of got off the 17-year anniversary thing and on to more substantial matters, I guess, about how substantial Christianity was and how it's not a house of cards. I mean, we're not going to knock it down real easily. I mentioned Sam Harris as one of the so-called new atheists, and I have in front of me something that I don't even know where I got this. It's some internet deal. He's written a book, Letter to a Christian Nation, and another one, The End of Faith. I guess it's an article in Newsweek called A Dissent, The Case Against Faith. I haven't read the entire thing. Well, maybe I did a while back, but I just earmarked a couple of sentences. And this tells me, this speaks volumes about Mr. Harris's breadth of understanding, at least about Christianity. And here's what he writes. Religion is the one area of our discourse in which people are systematically protected from the demand to give good evidence and valid arguments in defense of their strongly held beliefs. And yet these beliefs regularly determine what they live for, what they will die for, and all too often what they will kill for. Consequently, we are living in a world in which millions of grown men and women can rationalize the violent sacrifice of their own children by recourse to fairy tales. Now, this is just pregnant with opportunities for response, but let me make one very obvious observation, and that is equally true of everyone who is not religious. That is, it is very rare to find anyone, and I'm not saying Sam Harris is an example of this because he writes books giving reasons, but it is very rare to find anyone who could give anything like a thoughtful defense for their views on these deeper issues. And in fact, this is how people are manipulated so easily by charlatans and sophists, politicians, is that people don't think. They emote. They're carried away by images and by shallow emotional appeals. And so it is true that generally people, it's not just religion is the one area of our discourse. It isn't the one area. Virtually all areas of our discourse, people are systematically protected from the demand to give good evidence and valid arguments in defense of their strongly held beliefs. By the way, this is especially true in a postmodern world. Now, my sense is that Sam Harris is really more cut from a modernist mold. That is, he believes that there are truths and falsehoods, and atheism is true and all religions are false. But if you are taken by the postmodern turn in culture, then the question of truth isn't even an issue. It's all part of your story, and whatever your story is, that's good enough. So you certainly you are then, in postmodernism, systematically protected from the demand to give good evidence and valid arguments in defense of your strongly held beliefs. It isn't as if the secular world is rescued somehow from this proclivity of religion. Secondly, that's, by the way, taking his statement at face value as if it were accurate. Non-religious people are no better off. That's the first point. Second point, I don't think it's accurate. It may be accurate of individual religious people, and now let me just talk about our own faith community. This certainly is accurate about a lot of Christians who are protected from the demand to give good evidence and valid arguments in defense of their views. I see this all the time. It's why Stand to Reason is here. But remember what happened to me when I was down in San Diego at UCSD about 5 or 6 or 7 years ago now. I lose track of time. Melinda says don't cite dates or years because you sound senile because I always get them wrong. Down in San Diego, UCSD, and I was going on campus during their philosophy week on a Wednesday night to be it's a whole week of Christian speakers coming in, and I did the philosophy night, and I talked about relativism. Beforehand, I had dinner with a group of student leaders there from the Christian community and wanted to get kind of a handle on what was going on the campus. And the student leader said, well, I tell you, most of the people around here think that Christians are stupid. I thought, well, that's a good way to start my talk. So I did. I got up in front of the 400 people there in the ballroom and said, I understand most of you think that, or people here think that Christianities are stupid. Christians are stupid. Well, lots of them are. But, I said, lots of non-Christians are stupid too. So I don't know what that gets you. What I'm here to show you is that Christianity is not stupid. And you see, this is where Sam Harris should be spending his time. Instead of spinning his wheels looking at individuals who can't defend their faith, and pretending as if that means there is no defense. He should be looking at the defense of the faith that is offered, at least on behalf of Christianity. Because the libraries are thick with that kind of information. And as I said last hour, it isn't going to go away with him just waving his hand at it. And not only is it not the case that there are no defenses for Christianity, but it is not the case that classical Christianity even promotes the idea of just believing without reasons. Let me read his quote again. Religion is the one area of our discourse in which people are systematically protected from the demand to give good evidence and valid arguments in defense of strongly held beliefs. And here I want to go to 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 through 8. Because what I want to show is that even if some churches protect their people or some Christians are unaware, it is not the intent of those founders of Christianity and those early purveyors of it that Christians not use their mind, that they just take a leap of faith and they have no reasons for it. Because in 1 Corinthians 15... Well, let me back up before I give you the reference. If I were to ask you where is the single verse, where in the Bible, in the New Testament, is the verse that best captures the gospel, I think your first thought would be the Gospels, and specifically the Gospel of John in chapter 3 and verse 16. John 3:16. Everybody knows that. Even people who don't know anything else know that verse. But if I were to ask you where in Paul's writing do you have the clearest characterization of the simple gospel? Probably you would know where it is, but I'll suggest this one, 1 Corinthians 15:3-8. And in this passage, he tells what he delivers as of first importance. And here it is. Jesus says, I delivered, in fact, let me just find it, the verse itself. 1 Corinthians 15, I'll read it to you because I don't have it memorized. 3:4 and following. For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ Jesus died for our sins. Now, he doesn't stop there. He doesn't say, I'm telling you what somebody told me. He does say that, but he doesn't stop. What does he say after that? That Christ died for your sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried and raised on the third day according to the Scriptures. And that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, and after that he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom remain until now, but some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, as it were, to one untimely born, he appeared to me also. Now, I don't care whether you believe that Paul is telling the truth, whether this happened, whether this is a story or a fairy tale. This isn't my point. My point is whether biblical Christianity actually is the kind of faith system in which people are systematically protected from the demand to give good evidence and valid arguments in defense of their strongly held beliefs. It is not, because here's the Apostle Paul who says, yeah, here's the gospel. Jesus died for your sins according to the Scriptures. In other words, he's giving evidence. He said the Scriptures predicted this, and then he did it, Jesus. And then guess what? He rose from the dead. Do you think that's a good reason to believe somebody if he dies and then comes back from life? I'm not asking you if you thought Jesus did this. I'm asking you that if it happened, would that be a reason to take his views seriously? Yes, yeah, see the reason built in? Here's the simple gospel, the death and resurrection of Christ, the simplest way Paul could say it. And he still didn't leave out the apologetics, to put it bluntly. According to the scriptures, this is fulfilled prophecy. And then he appeared to a whole bunch of people. All the apostles, James, 500, me. We were eyewitnesses of this resurrected Christ. Now, again, you can take exception with the account. You can take exception with the claims. Not my point. My point is, Paul doesn't leave any room for any Christian to say that what it means to be a Christian is to be systematically protected from the demand to give good evidence and valid arguments in defense of their strongly held beliefs. Indeed, later on in the same chapter, Paul says, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, we're idiots. Well, actually, that's not quite the way he put it. Let me tell you his exact words. We are of most men to be pitied. Those are his words. We are pitiful if Jesus didn't rise from the dead. But he did. How do we know? Because he saw him. That's his point. So the point that I'm making is it may be that there are all kinds of religious views. In fact, there are. In which the people are systematically protected from the demand to give good evidence and valid arguments in defense of their strongly held beliefs. I think this is LDS. Mormonism is like this. They are systematically protected. But not biblical Christianity. Never has been like this. The history of Christianity from the beginning is thoughtful reflection on evidence that gives us knowledge in which we put our trust. John says at the end of his gospel, many more things, signs Jesus performed that are not written in this book. That book has a lot of them already. Many more are not written, but these have been written in order that you might believe that Jesus is the Son of God and in believing have life in his name. The whole book is written as a reason for trust, biblical faith. So Sam Harris does not understand Christianity. And apparently he is unfamiliar with the fact that virtually every single major thinker since the first century listed in the history of philosophy from the first century to about the 17th or 18th century, virtually every single one of them, the greatest thinkers of Western civilization, were committed biblical theists. Now, again, it doesn't mean that they're right. It means that this is not stupid. It means that this is not wishful thinking. It means that this is not an enterprise in which people are systematically protected from the demand to give good evidence and valid arguments in defense of their strongly held beliefs, just the opposite, which is one of the reasons I can sit here and be a Christian. 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code, and there we have a lot of open lines, 754-4150. Let's go to Mount Prospect, Illinois. And Joseph, did you know that I used to live right around the corner from you?
No kidding.
Prospect Heights.
Oh, my gosh. My kids go to Prospect High School.
No kidding. We lived in a subdivision kind of right on off of Camp McDonald Road, and actually had a buddy who had a front yard there right across from one of the – well, across the street was the golf course, and we stole a whole bunch of balls from the Stop and Sock place, and we sat in his front yard and knocked those balls across Camp McDonald Road and into the fairway. So the next guy to tee off lost his ball and about 1,000 other balls that we had. That was the last time I golfed, by the way. So I have fond memories of Prospect Heights, Mount Prospect. In fact, I was there when that mall opened. You know that mall? It looks like a spaceship sitting there. That was the first mall like it in the country, I think.
No kidding. It was a big hit.
Yeah, it really was. And now it's just like
struggling along. I think Woodfield Mall is eclipsing it.
Yeah, well, everything will eclipse that one now.
There's demographics out there.
Yeah, well, everything could eclipse that one because at the time it was big, now it's just a little bitty thing.
Yeah, exactly. But I can still take Randhurst Mall over the other shopping.
Is that right?
I just can't stand the big malls.
Uh-huh.
I just feel lost in them.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, it's really a treat to get to chat with you. Congratulations on 17 years.
Thank you.
I used to have a radio program in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, when I was doing Christian counseling before it was in vogue quite a few years ago.
Oh, okay.
And
you know what it's like.
Switchboards would light up every time I'd bring a client on that would talk about depression or anxiety.
Yeah, because there's a lot of people out there with it.
I had a blast.
Good.
It was a lot of fun, but it was also very anxiety.
Yeah, I can appreciate that
too.
What's on your mind, Joseph?
I wanted to not blame you, but I got a website from your program.
Okay.
And it was called monergism.com.
Uh-huh.
And I've been listening to several MP3 lectures by John Piper.
Piper, yeah. Monergism.com. Monergism would be one energy kind of thing if you think of it literally, but it's the idea that God is the single mover in our salvation. It's not both of us working together to rescue us from sin. It's God doing the work himself, which would be probably put that way would really be a Reformed or Calvinistic way of understanding it. Right.
That's what I wanted to call you about was that I've been soaking up so much Calvinism that just last week I just kind of went through a phase. I was waiting for my brother at the airport, and I was just starting to think, oh, my gosh, how do I know if I'm part of the elect? How do I know if my salvation experience is real?
Yeah.
And for a while there, I started to think, wait a minute, you know, how do I know I'm not just faking it? And then I really got discouraged.
Well, let me try to speak to that a little bit to you, Joseph.
Yeah, throw that out at you. It's a big detour from what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's okay. You know what I'd like to do here? I just got the sign that we're up against break. Let me go to break and put you on hold,
okay.
Then I'll come back and kind of give you it all in one shot, and we can knock it around a little bit, okay?
Okay, great. And some resources, too.
Well, let's see if what I say will help. I don't know. Let me think about that one. I'll come back in just a second. Greg Kolkel with more to come here on Stand to Reason.
Hi, I'm Greg Kolkel. You want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800 the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material, too, by using the brand-new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org or call 1-800-2 and the word reason.
Hi, Greg and Melinda. Happy 17th anniversary. This is Doy Stearns, the voice from the past, your Techno Cowboy Bird Operator from 1999 to 2002. Wishing you all in standard reason a happy anniversary and God bless you. Thanks.
Well, that was a flash from the past. Thank you, Deloy Stearns, our techno cowboy. That's what we called him. He was operated our boards for a number of years, so thank you. Let's see. Talking with Joseph right now. Let's get back to Joseph in Mount Prospect, Illinois. Hi, Joseph. The first thing that occurred to me when you raised your question about listening to these Reformed or Calvinistic MP3s and kind of getting more into this and all of a sudden thinking, oh, my gosh, I wonder if I'm one of the elect.
Yes.
The first thing that occurred to me, beyond the fact that this is very normal, lots of people raise this question when they begin to understand some of the notions of what the Bible teaches about election. The first thing that occurred to me is that being a Calvinist does not, or hearing this from Calvinists, or Calvinism in general, is no more vulnerable to this kind of charge than Arminianism.
Oh.
I mean, you could say Arminians have to believe in the elect too because the Bible teaches the elect. The difference between Calvinism and Arminians is the way one gets elect.
Yes.
In one case, God elects us. In the other case, we elect God. Okay, mm-hmm. I mean, to put it most simply, although since I always think the Arminian characterization of election is odd because we are the elect, and if God elects us, that makes sense of calling us the elect, just like if you got the president elect of somebody who's just elected. But
yes,
it doesn't seem to make
it's
sense
kind of redundant.
Well, it makes sense to say that we are the elect if we are the ones elected. But if we are the ones electing God, then God becomes the elect, not us. So how come? How is it the electorate becomes the elect? But in any event, there is an elect, and the question, the debate is how one gets elect. But there still is the elect, and you can always ask the question: maybe I'm not one of them.
Yes.
Now, you might say, oh, well, Arminian has it easier because the Arminian doesn't have to know the mind of God, who he chose. All he has to know is that if you believe in Jesus Christ based on the promise of God, then you're saved. That's what it says. We do it. We're saved. So we don't have this fight that the Calvinists have. But see, I don't have that either because the exact same answer applies to me as a Calvinist. I don't have to know the mind of God. All I have to know is what God's requirements are, and I have to fulfill those requirements.
So really, okay, you've just answered it. So really, it doesn't. It's a moot issue. When I start to try to know the mind of God, then I'm venturing off into a place where I don't need to go.
It's none of your business, simply put. As one person put it, you know, as R.C. Sproul put
it. Exactly.
That is the sovereign
because.
That is, the sovereign mind of God is not something you need to know. The mind of God that's revealed to us is something we need to know. But with regards to salvation, God has already told us what the criterion are. You want to know how to be the elect? You believe in Jesus. The minute you believe in Jesus, in the biblical sense,
mm-hmm.
and it's not some frivolous thing, but a genuine trust that Jesus, in Jesus, to do for you what you can't do for yourself, which is to save you, then you are the family of God, and the family of God is the elect, and you are one of the elect.
Yeah, well, I did that in March of 71.
There you go. And if you I think there are people who go through the motions and then mm-hmm. go their own way, and just because they say a magic prayer doesn't mean any magic happens, you know?
Right,
but if,
right.
if a person who is a follower of Jesus in virtue of what Jesus did for them, then, you know, then they're walking with the Lord. And
there'll be fruit in their life.
Yeah, and there's some fruit in their life. Well, gosh, that's the earmarks of a genuine Christian according to the Bible, and everybody's a little bit different in that regard. But you don't have to be wondering, geez, did God elect me? Because the way I understand it is when God elects a person, that person chooses Christ. So all you don't have access to whether or not what the mind of God is with regards to any individual's election, but you do have access to whether or not you chose Christ.
Exactly. I love this. This is exactly right. They don't put that in there when they talk about Calvinism. Calvin was an attorney, and he tried to create a theocracy, and he was really strong in his convictions. And if you didn't agree with him, I mean, he moved away from it. But if you didn't agree with him, you were in trouble.
Yeah, I don't know how much of that characterization is entirely accurate.
It's true.
But anyway, let's just set that aside because we're not talking about Calvin here. We're talking about some of the views that, that seem to be grounded in the Bible. And if there is an election that's grounded monergistically, that is in God's soul energy, as it were, his movement, that he's responsible for that, well, that manifests itself in a certain way. And this is a manifestation we can see. And the manifestation is that those whom God moves on, they actually are transformed so that they believe instead of rebelling.
Exactly.
So that all of those who are believing are the elect, and that is true from either perspective, Arminian or Calvinist. All those who are believing are the elect. If you are believing, you know you're the elect. It's just that simple.
You just knocked it out of the park.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that, Joseph, especially since...
Hole in one. How's that?
Yeah,
hole
that's
one.
Great. You're mixing
Thank
your metaphors
you
there, but I'll take
show.
It. All right. All the best to you, Joseph.
Show.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
It's, bye-bye.
Bye. It's good talking to you, and it's good to reminisce in a little bit about... Well, he said hole in one. He said knock it out of the park, then he said hole in one. But I was knocking the balls into the park, actually. Those would be the golf balls when I was in Prospect Heights. So just got a little bit of everything there. Let's go to Pasadena. Tony, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hey, thank you. Happy anniversary to both of you.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, to piggyback on talking about the existence of God, understanding it that metaphysically someone can say, sure, I can't be wrong. But in an epistemic manner, I understand that you can't say that. And I'm trying to wrap my brain around that and understand in what sense we're using the word necessary and then how it comes about that you can't say that.
Okay, well, let me recommend a title, and the title is Francis Schaeffer's He Is There and He Is Not Silent.
Okay.
I think that's the book where he has a whole chapter on the epistemological necessity of God.
Thank you. You know what's funny is I have that book.
Oh, okay. Well, go ahead and read the chapter. It's not too long, and probably if you have it, that means you're clever enough to follow the arguments, and I think it'll make more sense. Let me put it to you this way. I think I think that Schaeffer is arguing that given the fact that we can know things, that's the epistemology, that God is a necessary requirement for genuine knowledge. Now, I would probably want to soften my argument just a little bit and say arguing necessity is to argue a very, very strong thing. It's a strong claim, arguing necessity. But I don't think you have to argue necessity. I think if you just simply say, look, given that we do know things, what's the best reason that we know? Even if God is not necessary for knowledge, is he the best ground for knowledge? Does the fact that God exists help us to explain best how we can know things, such that if there is no God, it would be difficult to explain how our minds could be the kinds of minds that could know things, how our bodies could be the kinds of things that could gather accurate information from the world, and how the world can be the kind of place that would give us the kind of information that we would need in order to know true things about the world. Those are complicated things, and it just when one sits down to think about those, and it seems that understanding the existence of God, who does two things for us in the area of epistemology, helps answer the question. And two things that he does is he gives us a senses that can apprehend the world. He gives us a world that is orderly. He gives us a mind that can categorize with certain innate ideas that information that we're getting. And for those things that we can't get directly from our world through those tools that God has given us, and reason would be another one of them, then he tells us directly through revelation. So we have not only our rationality and the reliability of the senses and these categories in our minds that, and these intuitions about how the world works and how knowledge works that are in place, the machinery is there, but he also then adds more information for those things that we're not able to figure out on our own. Now, that's a nice little package. And if you don't have God in the mix, certainly you have no direct revelation, but it seems to be difficult to try to – how do you explain then how our minds are the way they are? How are and that would involve having an innate capacity to know laws of rationality. When I say know, that we know these things, we know the – and I'll give you the titles, law of excluded middle, law of non-contradiction, law of identity. We know those things. Now, maybe many people listening have never heard those terms, and they never – and if they heard them, they couldn't even tell you what they mean. But I guarantee you, you already know those things. They are built in, and you employ them every single day. Where do those come from? That's the point, because these are features of the mind that have to be in place for anything else to happen. Where do the laws of logic come from, for goodness sake? And so we're in a better position to explain those kinds of things.
And then how does that translate into, like, God not being a necessary creature? How do we what understanding of the word necessary does that mean?
Well, the word necessary, when used metaphysically, means that it could not have been otherwise.
Okay.
That it is not possible to have been otherwise. And I don't mean that the evidence is so strong. I'm saying that the nature of the thing itself is that it's not possible to have been otherwise. Contradictory statements cannot be both true at the same time. And that is a necessary truth, and it is not possible in any world for that not to be the case. The law of non-contradiction applies everywhere. It's a necessary principle. So that's what I mean by necessity in that sense. So when people are talking about necessity in terms of God, they're saying that God, when you fully grasp what God is, you realize that it is not possible that he could not exist. He is a necessary being. I don't buy that necessarily. I mean, I'm not convinced of that myself, but that's what they mean when they say that.
And then for what reason would you might not be convinced of that?
Well, to me, it's really, if I just reflect on the nature of the thing, law of non-contradiction, A cannot be not A at the same time and in the same way, I realize, yeah, that's true, and there's no getting around it.
Mm-hmm.
That God exists, that's necessary. It just doesn't have that property. You know, it doesn't present itself to my mind when I think about it. Like, oh, this is obviously true.
Okay,
and if it were so obviously true, well, there wouldn't be people who deny it so readily.
Okay, yeah, like a square circle. What about the fact that, like, if you understand the word square and circle, and you say there's no such thing as square circles, that's a necessary truth, but it's also self-evident.
Well, yeah, that's because the two contradict each other, so they can't be both in a sense the same. You can't have a one-sided thing, which would be a circle, and a force, and a thing that is not one-sided but is four-sided instead at the same time. It's either one or the other, or some other option, but they can't be both.
Okay, and then if you were to say that God exists, you have to make arguments, even though I understand what you mean by God and everything. If I have to make a case for it, the ontological argument, the argument from design, or what have you, then Is that sort of like, then that means it's conditional if my arguments are wrong?
You know, that's a very good observation. If you have to make an argument for it, then it's obvious it's not necessary. I mean, that would be a way of arguing.
Okay, but I didn't know if I was on the right track with that.
No, do I argue, am I going to give you an argument why there can't be any square circles?
Right.
No, I'm not going to, right? Because you just think about it and you realize, oh, yeah, well, yeah, no argument necessary. But there does seem to be arguments necessary for God to persuade people. So it's not obvious that this is the existence of God is one of those things that you can't do without. And therefore, it seems to me that undermines the idea that God is a necessary being. So that's why I just don't go there. Maybe there's some philosophers that really like that and other philosophers understand it. But the rank and file, they're not going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think offering arguments for, you know, the evidence for God through ontology, the ontological or rather the cosmological argument or the design argument or some of these others, the moral argument, I think is very persuasive. Then you've got, it's a little different then. So I just presume that people don't believe in God because he's a necessary being, but there are some features of reality that we seem to behold for which God seems to be the best explanation. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And morality would be one of them. Design would be another. The existence of the universe would be another. So these – and I don't think there's any other explanation that's going to even come close.
And you're saying that I could be wrong. You know, like you said, I could be wrong that exists. Is there anywhere in the biblical example that where any of the believers, like Paul going out and saying, oh, you know,
no,
here's the gospel, but I could be wrong?
No.
Okay.
No, so I'm not offering – I am not modeling the behavior of those in the Bible when I say that. I'm being intellectually honest.
Uh-huh, okay.
I could not tell you. There's no possibility I could be wrong. Now, maybe Paul could.
Mm.
And Paul might be saying, in terms of psychological confidence, because of his close encounters with Jesus and all those other things, he is utterly convinced that he's right. And obviously, he was utterly convinced because look what he did.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't say that. I don't have those same experiences that he did.
Mm.
I think that I'm right, but I could never say that there's no possibility that I'm wrong.
But he did have doubt, right? Like he went back to make sure the message. I heard Gary Habermas talk about.
He had doubts about certain things. I don't know if he ever doubted that Jesus was the Messiah or that God existed. I don't think he doubted that.
Message time. Okay.
But he had fears and doubts in that he talks about that in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, I believe, or maybe 5 or 6 or 7. I just went through those chapters a couple of days ago, so I remember seeing it there. Paul himself doubted. He was fearful.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jesus dealt with the doubts, but it didn't say what he was doubtful about.
Okay.
And I'm actually looking for it now. But so he had his liabilities or his difficult times. But I don't know that he doubted the core thing itself.
The gospel message.
Yeah, the gospel message, yeah. Or God's existence or something like that. I'm looking for it. It's probably in chapter 5 or 6, but he talks about it. I thought I had a little writing down in my margin here. Okay.
All right.
There you go.
Thank you.
Hope that helps. I appreciate your call. Let's see. Let's run to a break a little early here. And because we're almost up to it, and I want to give Ron in San Diego his full shot. Lines open, 1-800-227-5278. I'm Greg Kokel with Clear Thinking Christianity.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Standard Reason, include discussions on is the supernatural real? Is Jesus a prophet or the Son of God? Do all roads lead to God? Did Jesus rise from the dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at SDR.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Greg Kokel back with you here at Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Sunday from 3 until 5. That would be Los Angeles time if you want to call in from some other part of the world, which many people do. By the way, congratulations to James McLean of Miller, South Dakota. Jim, if you're listening, you are our Frapper winner for this week. We'll be sending you, a relativism book, probably. That's what we usually do. Free gift from Stand to Reason, because we drew your name from the list of those people who've gone to our website and hit the podcast button and then registered on the Frapper map. If you'd like to do that, your name will also be put in to a barrel we'll pick from that. I don't know how we do it. We must do it electronically. If we choose you, you'll be the winner. We'll send you a free gift, too. So it's a way of kind of making yourself known to other members of the Stand to Reason community. So, again, congratulations to Jim McLean of Miller, South Dakota. Friends, I found that verse that I was talking about with the last caller, Tony, I guess it was, chapter 7 of 2 Corinthians. Now, I misspoke, kind of, because the passage doesn't say that Paul was doubting. It says here, verse 5, chapter 7, 2 Corinthians, "For even when we came into Macedonia," that would be Greece, northern Greece, "and our flesh had no rest, but we were afflicted on every side, conflicts without, fears within. But God, who comforts the depressed, comforted us by the coming of Titus," and not only by his coming, but also by the comfort from which he was comforted in you, etc. So here Paul says, conflicts without, fears within, but God comforts us because God comforts the depressed. Now, I think it's pretty fair to say that Paul was afraid and he was depressed. That's right there. Paul is afraid. Paul was depressed. By the way, this is Corinthians. He's writing to a church there in the area of Greece, talking about when he was there in that area. But when you read the book of Acts, when he actually was there, it was either Athens or Corinth. Jesus said, appeared to Paul, he said, "Do not be afraid any longer, for I have many people in this city." And then Paul went forth with a fury. So there's another place where identified Paul was afraid. Now, why are we afraid? In that situation, wouldn't it be fair to say that we're fearful because we're doubting? And when Jesus appears, the doubts depart, and therefore there's no more fear. So I think implicitly it's pretty clear that Paul had some doubts of some sort and was not only discouraged and afraid but depressed, and Jesus shows up to comfort him, encourage him, to fill his tank and to send him out with boldness. And I suspect that happened when he didn't have as many doubts. So I think it's fair to say, from that passage, though it doesn't use the word doubt, that might have been what was going on. But I don't mean to suggest that what he was doubting was that Jesus was Jesus, or that God was God, maybe some other aspect. We don't know. Down in San Diego, we've got Ron. Welcome to the show, Ron.
Hi, Greg.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. I want to wish you a happy anniversary.
Thank you.
And I wanted to thank you for your ministry. I've been listening to you since 1993, 1994.
Wow, you're an old timer. That's yeah. Right around the time we changed the show to Stand to Reason, the name we have now.
Okay.
Before that, first off the bat, it was Talk from the Heart, and then it was The Areopagus and Cutting Edge and The Show with No Name, and finally we started Stand to Reason in 1993, and so we adopted this name.
Okay.
Good.
Yeah, I want to thank you for your ministry.
You're welcome.
To be a thinking Christian and a thinking Pentecostal, I want to say that.
Well, good. I was going to say you're a rare bird, but I thought, well, that's probably not kind, because I know many thinking Pentecostals, but there's a lot of emoting Pentecostals too, you know. So I guess anyway, glad you're on board.
Thank you. I just want to let me explain my situation. I was born and raised in the Church of God in Christ, which is a sister church of Assemblies of God.
Yeah.
In fact, I was reading a book, Century of the Spirit. And it talked about how actually the Assemblies of God broke off from the Church of God in Christ due to some racism in the 20s or whatever,
uh-huh.
You know, back in the day. And now I'm involved in a Calvary Chapel church here in San Diego. And
what's your concern there? No Pentecostalism in that Calvary Chapel anymore, right?
Well, let me say this. I like the description that Hank Hintergraff gave a few years ago. Someone asked about Calvary Chapel Church, and he said it was a mildly Pentecostal church.
Yeah, probably mildly charismatic is a better word to use to describe them, yeah.
Right.
So you have some manifestation of gifts in a very mild way in certain areas and a kind of an exuberance in worship and stuff like that, but they don't promote kind of a hardline Pentecostal theology and the second blessing and pushing of tongues, second blessing in the sense that the baptism of the Spirit is the speaking of tongues, and you get that sometime after you become a Christian, and they're not heavy into the revelatory concerns that I've spoken of, like the prophecy and the reading between the lines in scriptures and hearing the voice of God and that kind of thing,
right.
Which isn't unique to Pentecostalism, but it certainly is there in spades.
Right. Now,
so your question is what, Ron?
Well, my dilemma is this. I got involved with this Calvary Chapel Church because I've had some problems with substance abuse in the past.
Uh-huh.
And they have the certain church that I belong to has a men's sober living home. So I live there now.
Okay.
But I'm getting ready to leave, in the next year. And I was kind of, I wanted to go back to my roots. I visited an Assemblies of God church, and I liked how they worship, and, it kind of reminded me of a Calvary Chapel church.
Okay, Ron, let me give you a couple of quick thoughts here, okay? Mm-hmm. I think there may be three things that you should be thinking of broadly now when you're thinking about choosing the church. One of them should be your theology. One of them should be the worship. And I think one of them should be the kind of community that you're involved with. Now, a lot of times people think of the community and worship because those are the affective elements. That is the feeling stuff. You come in and say, hey, I like these people. Wow, good worship.
Right.
I'm here. They don't look at the theology.
Right.
But to me, the theology is really important. And all three are important, but I would probably put the theology first. But it doesn't mean that everything in the church that I would go to has to be right along the lines of what I believe. If they're broadly in the park and they're not making any big mistakes, or maybe they hold some – the church that I go to now is a pre-trib rapture church. No, I don't believe in that.
Okay.
And I think I have really good reasons to reject it, but it doesn't matter. I'm not going to make a fuss there. This is a tertiary issue. God's going to decide when we go ultimately, and it doesn't affect a lot of other things.
Okay.
So I'm not fussing about that. But if they were really legalistic or a works church or something like that, I wouldn't be there.
Right.
So if they were, I probably would not feel comfortable in a Pentecostal church ever again in terms of my regular home because of certain theological things.
Okay.
So the Arminianism, their views of revelation and about people getting words from God all the time and whatever. I'm not against prophecy, but I don't think in 8 years at a pastor in a Pentecostal church, I don't think I ever heard the real McCoy. I just heard a lot of nonsense, and it's not really managed properly in most Pentecostal churches. So,
all right.
So you have to ask yourself, Ron, gosh, I know I like the worship there, but do I agree with the theology? And if you agree with the theology and you like the worship and the community is a warm, welcoming one for you, you know, in the way you interact with people, then, you know, you got a trifecta there. But if you like the theology, but, you know, you just – the worship leaves you cold.
Right.
Well, you know, you need that affective element in your spiritual life. So,
right.
So I think those are the three things you should be thinking about in general,
now,
lining up.
Can you define the community part?
Well, the community is kind of like how the people are towards you.
Oh, okay.
Didn't you say there was kind of racism in one environment or something you referred to? Oh, you referred to why the church split.
Right.
Okay, well, if there's, you know, if you got racism, that...
Me being African-American, okay.
Okay.
I kind of, when I went to the Army, like about 15 years ago, I kind of had an epiphany like Malcolm X did when he went to Mecca, about how, you know, Islam, you know, really wasn't a racist
right.
Religion. And since I grew up in an all-black church, an all-black Pentecostal church, and I got saved in an all-black Pentecostal church, I had never fellowshipped with anybody but black Christians.
Right. Well, this is...
I kind of had an epiphany, you know, the same way that there are people who love Jesus.
Sure. There you go. Now, Ron, this is what I'm talking about, community. And it's not just the racial thing, although I think you should be comfortable where you go, but there's a cultural thing. You know, black culture is different than white culture.
Right.
I mean, you go to a black church that's predominantly black, they got rhythm, man. They got a whole different way of doing things. And
right.
I'm not saying right or wrong. I'm saying that's a unique cultural setting that some people feel real comfortable in. Other people don't.
Right.
And sometimes you got a mixture. So that's what I'm talking about the community thing. Okay, I got to run. I got some other another caller here. But
you
got to ask yourself questions in those three areas, okay?
Thank you, brother.
Okay, Ron, great talking to you. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Michael. And Mike, you made it.
Hi, Greg. How you doing?
Doing good, thanks.
Love you, and we long-time supporters.
That's great.
So
thank
here's
you,
my
Mike.
Question in short. My wife was baptized as a teenager in her junior year in high school. And she was sprinkled, in a sense, kind of laying on hands on top of
sure.
from a Presbyterian church. She went through, I think it was about a 9-week confirmation before she became baptized.
Right. That's common in liturgical churches for adult baptism.
And so now, attending the church we're attending, the pastor is saying, in effect, that if you were sprinkled, that wasn't good enough, so you need to be immersed. So my question is that if she, by faith, accepted the practice of the Presbyterian Church, and now if she were to take that and say, well, I kind of doubt what I did when I was a teenager, even though it was intellectually sound
uh-huh.
at the time,
yeah.
and now go at the behest of the pastor and say, well, I need to do what he's saying.
Yeah. Okay, let me ask you a question, though. What does the pastor think that water does for somebody?
Well,
such that the water didn't do it.
Specifically.
Okay, and let me add this thought. Such that whatever the water does, the water didn't do it the first place because there wasn't enough of it. And the second case, what he's suggesting, immersion, there's enough water to do what water's supposed to do.
Mm.
So what is it that's supposed to do?
I guess it's supposed to be a symbolic representation of the changed life.
Okay, if it is a symbolic representation of the changed life, then why does the volume of the water matter when it's a symbol?
Yeah. Well, I guess that the thought is that the biblical method is the immersion.
Okay, fair enough. Let's just say that were the case. There's a difference between description and prescription, right?
Yeah.
So we see when you say the biblical method is immersion, I'm trying to think where exactly does it say that? It just says they were baptized. Now, you can go to historical material maybe and come to the conclusion that baptism for the Jews was accomplished by immersion, and this was patterned after baptism for the Jews, and people were then immersed. But I don't know any place in the Bible, if you're going to say what the biblical pattern was. I don't know, and I could be wrong here.
I think he's looking at the Greek word baptismo, which is meaning to immerse.
Well, that would be the baptize is a transliteration from baptismo, and that picture there was a dunking in and soaking with the water and the dye. You know, it's a garment from the garment industry. They take a shirt that's white, they put it in with a red dye, and they immerse it and they bring it up. That's certainly the picture, okay? Of course, just because that's the word, the root history of the word, you know, sometimes you can go awry by you know, it's like in Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, where God wants he wants a cheerful giver. And people say, well, that's the root word of laughter. He wants a hilarious giver. So when we give the money today, let's all start laughing. Ah! Well, that isn't what Paul means. He doesn't mean everybody should have a belly laugh when he gives. He means cheerful. And so what they've done there is committed the root word fallacy. And so, you know, your pastor may be doing the same thing. I'm not saying he is. I'm just simply making the point that we have to be careful. If you say this is the biblical teaching, then where does the Bible teach that we should be immersed? It doesn't teach that. It doesn't even describe immersions. What he's doing is he's doing an analysis based on the word, baptismo, and he's assuming that that's the way it happened. And then he's also assuming since the early church did it that way, that we have to do it that way, or it doesn't even count. And that seems a little bit strained from my perspective. So I would say it's a matter of choice for your wife if she wants to do it and make the pastor happy. Fine. You know what? A lot of times people require a baptism into their new community anyway. I wouldn't make a big fuss about it.
Well, interesting thing I think of is that if she did it at once when she was younger and a mandate that she felt she was being obedient to Scripture, now if she does it at understanding that the mandate is to be obedient to Scripture, what if we leave this church, go to another pastor who says, well,
I think it would be good to have clear in your mind what you think is actually going on. I don't think that she was disobedient in the first case and now she's being obedient in the second case. I think the first one was adequate, and I don't know what more water is going to actually do. So, but you may, just to kind of keep the peace and whatever and go through and join this church, have a new baptism and do it for that reason, but not under the sense that you made a mistake the first time and that you're doing it right the second time. Anyway, out of time here, Mike. Thanks for the call. I hope that was helpful. And I will be back with you next week. In the meantime, friends, be good ambassadors if you're followers of Christ. And if you're not, I hope I gave you something worth thinking about today, a little stone in your shoe. Go on, have a good week. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. You go and give them heaven this week, friends. Bye-bye now.